Studying objects and using them for research is nothing new to this museum podcast. But studying objects found underwater most certainly is. Today we'll hear from Paul Johnston, curator of maritime history here at the National Museum of American History. Paul will be talking about a few of his experiences in underwater archaeology and how he's conducted research from objects found within shipwrecks. Paul talks specifically about two shipwrecks, one that has already been found, and another that he hopes to find that could potentially provide new information into the transatlantic slave trade.
Hi, I'm Paul Johnston. I'm curator of maritime history at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. And for the research area of my job is something I do in archaeology. We also do collections management and collecting for the National Collections and exhibits as well. But in this case, my research component of my job is with shipwrecks. And some people like to know, what actually does a shipwreck archaeologist do? And the simple answer to that is we study shipwrecks, and the reason we study shipwrecks is manyfold. The main reason actually has to do with terrestrial archaeology sites. In a land site, you might have 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 years of occupation all in one city, for example. If you're excavating a city in the ancient world, in Greece or Rome or Israel or any of the Arabian Peninsula, you might be working on a site that's been occupied for thousands of years. But a shipwreck is like a little time capsule of whatever culture produced it and sent it out on the world's oceans to go from one place to another. Most ocean-going ships actually contain everything that they needed to stay alive and stay safe. So they're perfect little cities of their own, little miniature cities of their own, with everything needed to survive and thrive and trade and explore, communicate, or immigrate, whatever the purpose of the ship was. So when a ship sinks with all of its cargo on board, you can, by excavating it scientifically, you can derive a good idea of the culture that produced that ship and all of the things on it. The other unique thing about the underwater environment is that it is basically anaerobic. There's very little oxygen in there. And without much oxygen, things tend to stabilize very quickly and be preserved. And by that I mean organic things in particular, like wood or fabric or sailcloth or baskets or waxes. In some cases, the world's earliest book was actually found on a shipwreck dating to about 1300 BC. And the original scratchings in the wax were still visible because the ship sank in almost 200 feet of water. So with very little oxygen and very little light, things go into a condition of stability, and then they can basically be preserved for hundreds or even thousands of years. So that's what makes shipwrecks so interesting to me.
Now, your most recent project was this royal yacht, Cleopatra's Barge. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe how you located it?
Yeah, actually that relates to the first job I had in museums, which was being the maritime curator at the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts. And the ship that I learned about was on the first day I got the job there. I was taken through a gallery of amazing artifacts that were from the first ocean-going yacht that was ever built in America. And it happened to be built in that town, in Salem, Massachusetts, by the son of one of the wealthiest men in America, who died, and then his estate was broken up among his sons, and one of his sons decided to build the first ocean-going yacht. And he named it kind of whimsically Cleopatra's Barge after a few lines in Antony and Cleopatra by William Shakespeare. And he spent about $50,000 building the ship and then another $50,000 fitting it out. And this was in 1816, right after the War of 1812 ended. And that was a lot of money then, when a normal brig, like the one he built, about 100 feet long and about 190 tons, would have cost about $6,000. So he spent $100,000 on it, and it was so unusual, both in the way it was built and laid out and fitted out, as well as the amount spent on it, that up to 8,000 people a day came to see the thing on its one and only voyage. He did that voyage in the winter of 1817 and then died the following spring planning his next trip. So his brother took the ship and sold it to a couple of China traders in Boston named Bryant and Sturgis. They were a trading company in the China trade. They then turned around and flipped it over to the then King of Hawaii, King Liholiho, who was the son of Kamehameha the Great. And Liholiho used it as his private yacht for about 3.5 years and then decided he wanted to go to England to meet King George, whom he considered merely another cousin of a few island groups like himself. And at first he was going to take the ship, which he had renamed Haʻaheoho Hawaii, or the Pride of Hawaii, but then cooler heads prevailed and he ended up on a British whaler. And this was in November 1823, so he had had the ship about 4 years. So he and his crew and his entourage climbed on the British whaler and made their way over to England. Meanwhile, the native Hawaiian crew took the ship out on a reconnaissance trip to see if they could study some of the politics on the faraway island known as Kauai, which is the farthest of the Hawaiian islands from Honolulu, where the royal family resided. And now the story gets a little murky because three things seem to have happened. One, the crew got drunk. Two, the anchor parted cable. And three, there was a storm that came up and dashed the ship against a reef in the southwest corner of Hanalei Bay on the island of Kauai. And those of you who know that area know how pretty it is. It's one of the most beautiful spots in the Hawaiian Islands, and it is the area after which Puff the Magic Dragon was named, the famous folk song by Peter, Paul, and Mary. So in the mid-90s, I got a permit to go out and look for Cleopatra's barge, and what made it a worthwhile search was that there was a Boston missionary named Hiram Bingham who had gone out there a few years before, about 1819 or 1820, and he'd been preaching to the Hawaiians and trying to convert them to Christianity. And he happened to be on Kauai when the ship wrecked. And he immediately went up to Hanalei Bay and preached a sermon to the native Hawaiians against the evils of drink. And he was able to point at and use the wreck of the Pride of Hawaii in the bay as a graphic example of what could happen if you had too much to drink. And in so doing, he actually described exactly where the ship went down. Hmm. And so basically, in the mid-90s, I went out there with a copy of his memoirs and marked X on the map, and we dropped a metal detector over the side and found the ship in about 48 hours. And then spent the next 5 years excavating it and doing research on the archival remains. So this was actually an example of historical archaeology where we were consulting both the historical record as well as the archaeological record, blending the two into the final story of the ship, what had happened to it, what was left on board, and why it was actually there.
Now, did no one really know about Hiram Bingham's reference to where the boat was prior to you looking it up, or did no one really just act on
the location? No one had acted on it. In fact, Clive Cussler, the famous novelist and author, had been out there a few years before us and had done a surface survey for it, but he wasn't able to find it. And the reason he couldn't find it is because it was under the sand. It had reburied itself, kind of scoured itself down under the sand and stabilized. Even though it's a very dynamic area, there have been two tsunamis since the 1940s, and in fact, in 1991, just a few years before we went out there, a hurricane in Niki stalled for 3 hours over Hanalei Bay. It destroyed the island, but it stalled over Hanalei Bay and just tore the shoreline into bits, and we were afraid there might not be very much left. But in fact, it was deep enough in the sand that it had stabilized over the years. So we found quite a lot. We found about 1,200 lots of artifacts, and a big chunk of the hull, of the port side of the hull, the left side of the hull, represented about 40%. So we found quite a bit there. We were surprised at how much we did find. Now, the ship had been salvaged within a couple of weeks of its loss in 1824, and Bingham described how hard the native Hawaiians worked to recover the sails and the rigging and as many of the artifacts from the ship as they could. It was a very famous ship even in Hawaii at mm-hmm. the time.
Now, did you bring everything up from the ship when you found it? Or is there, in underwater archaeology, do you ever leave things behind? Or how does that work?
We do. We recorded and left behind the hull. We did what's called backfilling. We uncovered the hull. We recorded all the details of the construction, and then we put the sand back where it had been with protection against the hull itself in case anyone ever wanted to go back and excavate it. Unfortunately, the hull itself was very delicate because of the so-called teredo worm, which is kind of like an underwater termite. These worms actually eat through the wood and leave little tunnels through the wood that make it so soft you can actually push your thumb through a 4-inch piece of oak within 10 or 20 years of the teredos having been in it. So the wood was really too delicate to raise and recover. So we recorded it and covered it back up again. We did recover about 1,200 lots of artifacts, everything from clearly material from the wreck site right up to modern things like divers' masks and weight belts and the skeg of a surfboard. It's a very popular surfing spot out there. So we found an interesting mixture of both the new and the old.
So now your newest project, the slave ship Enrique, can you talk about this and how you learned about the ship?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. After wrapping up the barge and having a book about 90% along on what happened and what we found, I wanted to dig into another project that I thought might make a real contribution to our knowledge of missing areas in American history. And one of the areas where there's the greatest gap is in the actual mechanical side of the slave trade. And that is, how were the slaves actually transported from Africa over to the New World? And so I put out the word among the archaeological community worldwide, and I said, does anyone know of an American slave ship that might have sunk? And a lot of my friends and colleagues all over the place looked in their records, and they really couldn't find anything. So we had to take another approach, and that was try to find a shipwreck archivally through the historical record. And we started by going up to Rhode Island, which Bristol, Rhode Island, in fact, which is the seat of the biggest and wealthiest and most powerful slave trader in all of American history, a guy named James DeWolfe. And he was not only a slave trader, but he was an ocean merchant and a banker and an insurance owner, company owner, and a general businessman. And what made him special was that because he had so many different interlocking businesses, all the records were preserved. Now, normally the records of a slave trader tend to be destroyed on purpose or not even kept, because after 1808, the American slave trade was illegal. And so people who were in the trade did not want to keep any records that could get them in trouble. However, DeWolfe had so many different businesses all interlocked that he did keep records. And we located a particular slave ship that was not only an American ship, which was my goal to find an American slaver because nobody's ever found one before, but also I wanted to find a ship that had actually been on a Middle Passage voyage that was coming from Africa to the New World with a cargo of slaves. No one had ever found that before either. Four slave ships have been found in the world, but none of them were on the Middle Passage at the time they sank. And this ship also sank with the human cargo on board. So it was an American ship on the Middle Passage that sank with the human cargo. So for me, those were the three aspects of this particular ship that made it interesting. Now, it sank in 1817, which was after slavery had been banned, slavery to the United States. However, it was not illegal between Africa and the Caribbean, for example, or Spain or Portugal, or the Arabian Peninsula, or many of the other countries. Only England and America had banned it by 1808. And so this Rhode Island trader had plantations in Cuba that he needed slaves for. He had sugar plantations. Not only did he have five sugar plantations, but his slave ship captain also had a plantation. And two of the plantations were in Matanzas Bay, which is a nice, very deep bay about 50 miles to the east of Havana, Cuba. And DeWolfe had a plantation right there, and then several others in the Matanzas Peninsula, or the province rather. And we believe that he was transporting slaves directly from West Africa right to Matanzas, where he would put them to work. So he was not bringing slaves at that point up to the United States. He was limiting their transport to his Cuban plantations. Now, in early 1817, this particular ship named the Enrique was under sail from West Africa to Matanzas Bay, and all of a sudden a British anti-slaver patrol ship picked it up. and had it under chase, and we believe that Enrique cut, there's a big reef just to the east end of the mouth of the bay. We believe that Enrique actually was cutting the reef a little too close, scraped out its bottom, and started sinking. And we know that the crew survived, so we think there was probably a small boat on board that the crew all climbed into. We also know that all of the cargo, the human cargo, perished. And so somewhere between 113 and 278 slaves were on board. The archival documents aren't quite sure about that. So that's the ship that we're looking for, and we've applied to the Cuban government for permission to look for this particular ship, and if we can find it, to survey it and see what might be left. All we really know about the actual transport of slaves from Africa to the New World is based on literary sources. And a lot of these sources had particular points of view that were dictated by, oh, let's just say, political pressures of the period. For example, there are three or four graphic pictures, plans, if you will, or layouts of slave ships from the 18th and early 19th century, but in fact all of those pictures were produced by abolitionist societies. So we don't really know what a slave ship looked like inside objectively. We know what the abolitionists wanted everyone else to believe, and so all of the pictures show certain levels of crowding and a number of different levels within each deck of how the slaves were stacked up. Is that really true? Well, we don't know. No one has ever actually found a slave ship that was on the Middle Passage with the slave decks laid in it. We also don't know such basic and simple things as whether the slaves were actually bound once they were on board the ship. Were they shackled? Some scholars look at the evidence and say, yes, they were shackled. Others say, no, they weren't. They didn't need to be, because as soon as they were on the ship, nobody knew how to swim, so they were effectively captives anyway, so there was no point in shackling them. Others say, well, you had to shackle them to make sure they didn't have an uprising or a mutiny or something like that. So that's the kind of question that we might also be able to answer. There were also there was something called the Equipment Clause in an 1820 Anglo-Dutch agreement, and it was basically anti-slavery didn't know whether a ship was slaving or not. How would you know whether a slip you were chasing was a slaver? Well, you needed to have certain equipment on board. And the Equipment Clause of the Anglo-Dutch Agreement explains, it almost has a shopping list of the things that you would find on a ship that would identify it as a slaver. Large cook pots, you'd find extra timber that would be used for building in the slave bunks, you'd find extra shackles, things like that. And so that gives us a bit of a shopping list on what to look for. We expect to find lots of shipwrecks at the mouth of this bay because it was a very busy bay with sugar trade going on for 150 years. But we would basically expect to flesh out the reality and strip away the political skin that has been put on all the descriptions of the slave trade and really find out what really went on board these ships, how it was carried out, at least in this particular case.
Thanks to Paul Johnston for taking the time to discuss his research with us. For the History Explorer podcast, this is Matt Ringelstetter. Be sure to join us again next month as we take another look behind the scenes here at the National Museum of American History. Podcast made possible by a grant from the Verizon Foundation.